I am deeply indebted, and I mean this very earnestly, to Larry Rasmussen for his Bible studies, in which he got us thinking about, got me thinking about what, how we read Scripture, and from that into a sense of what do we mean when we say that behavior is moral or ethical, which I have always seen as simply a footnote to legal or illegal, that is, carrying consequences, different consequences. If you don't do what society expects of you, they may not put you in jail, but they may bring social pressure to bear. You know, the neighborhood kids sneer at you. And that's a pretty potent lever when you think about it. It's maybe worse than paying a fine. And if that's true, isn't that really a lawful exercise? And if it's going to be punishment, shouldn't it be subjected to control so that we are not unnecessarily or dysfunctionally mean to each other? Now, I'm deeply indebted to Joel and to Marty. Marty for his devotional last night, in which he said that God's love is always unconditional. And Joel really this morning set beautifully for what I wish to share with you, and I hope you share with me, about what we mean by God's covenant with man. And isn't God's covenant with man always conditional? A very bad kind of analogy, a very inadequate kind of analogy. A dentist looks at you and says that, "I know that you have no money. I also know that you have a bad tooth, which is paining you, and I'm perfectly willing, without payment, to fix that tooth for you if you will come into my office and sit down in the chair and open your mouth and not bite me when I'm working." Now, coming into the office, sitting in the chair, opening your mouth, and not biting the man when he's, or the woman, when he or she is working, is not payment. But it is a set of circumstances, a fact, a condition, which has to happen before the tooth can be fixed. If you won't open your mouth, the tooth cannot be fixed. Is God's grace always conditioned upon man's openness to receiving the blessing? But God's grace is never bought as an exchange of value. That's the problem. And that's why both Marty and Joel raise in my mind, what does a theologian mean when he says God's love is always unconditional? Will God force me to open my mouth and have my tooth fixed even though I don't want to? Or is not God's love always gracious, and God gives me freedom to receive or to reject his gracious act of love? Is that true of law ever? If law is an exercise of control by government, where government tries to help us live together more effectively and less violently, so that I don't have to resort to violence, if I can go to a judge and have a conflict settled. But must that judgment always be fair and therefore not gracious? Can government ever be gracious, or must it always be lawful? I invite you now to share my headache with me when I think about what we may mean when we talk to each other about law and gospel. Luther's, if indeed he is to be faulted for this, famous or infamous two kingdoms. The kingdom on the right, God's grace, and the kingdom on the left, God's institution of order, including government. And can we ever blend those two, or must they always be and separate from each other? And rather than holding each other constructively in some sort of a tension so that neither one swings out of focus and becomes dysfunctional, if God's grace can ever be dysfunctional, rather than doing that, rather than holding each other in a constructive tension and reinforcing each other, must they be seen as being inimical to each other? And Joel was all over that this morning in the Bible study. When the prophet used the covenant to establish government, it became demonic and destructive. May I read what Joel said that way? Or is that not true? The kingdom of heaven is like a man that is a householder, which went out early in the morning to hire laborers in his vineyard. When he had agreed with the laborers for a penny a day, $50 a day would be perhaps better today, depending on which labor union you belong to, he sent them out into the vineyard. And he went out again about the third hour, and he saw others standing. And then, because Bibles always have such thin pages and I always have such thick fingers, I've got to get the page turned. There we go. He saw them standing idle in the marketplace, and he said to them, "Go also into the vineyard, and whatever is right." Notice he doesn't say the $50 or the penny. He says, "Whatever is right, I will give you." And they went their way. Meaning they went out in the vineyard and got to work, I guess. And again he went out in the sixth and the ninth hour, getting closer and closer to the end of the day, and did likewise. And about the 11th hour he went out and he found others standing idle, and said to them, "Why are you standing here all day idle?" They said to him, "Because no man's hired us." And he said unto them, "Go you also into the vineyard, and whatever is right, that shall you receive." Digress for just one moment and call your attention again to the first verse. For the kingdom of heaven is like unto a man, and so forth. Are you in the kingdom of heaven? Or don't you get into the kingdom of heaven until you die and go to Minnesota or something of that sort? Is God's kingdom now? And are you a member of it? Okay, back to the text. So when the evening was come, the Lord of the vineyard said unto his steward, "Call the laborers and give them their hire, beginning from the last unto the first." And when they came that were hired about the 11th hour, they received every man a penny, the full $50. And when they had received it, but when the first came, they supposed that they should have received more. And they likewise received every man a penny. And when they received it, they murmured against the good man of the house, saying, "Well, these last have worked but 1 hour, and you've made them equal unto us, and we have borne the heat and the toil of the day." But he answered one of them and said, "Friend, I do you no wrong. Did you not agree with me for a penny? Is it not lawful for me to do what I will with my own?" Is your eye evil because I'm good? And that's where that one ends. Suppose that the people who were hired first went down to the board of the Commission of Against Discrimination, or to the local labor relations board, and said there's obvious discrimination going on here, unequal pay. Would the law be entitled to say to the employer, well, it's your money, you can do whatever you like with it? Or must the law say you must treat people justly and fairly and give everybody this the hourly wage that is prescribed? That's too tough. Let me make it easier. The laborer says to these people, I'm into peaches this year rather than vineyards, and I'll pay you $50 a day, or whatever is fair. And just as soon as I sell the crop, why, we will all get paid, and I'll keep the balance for having tended the peaches and watered them and fertilized them and so forth for the year. So they all work, and they all pack up the fruit, and they take it down to sell it. And they get down there, and they expect to have at least $1,000 or better for the fruit. And they are met by the person and says, well, maybe you haven't heard, but we've got Mediterranean flies. And we can't buy your peaches and send them out. They'll have to be crushed here, and the best we can do is crush them and make jelly out of them. And there's so many on the market here, since nobody can send them out, that we can only give you $100. Oh, says the employer, that's bad news indeed, but please don't give me the $100. I have four people here. One of them has worked all day, one of them has worked since noon, one of them has worked 1 hour, and there's this fourth fella who couldn't get out to the field at all because he had to meet with his parole officer and got laid up in the AA meeting. But he really needs some money. So even though he didn't get out to the peaches to help us bring them in, I certainly would like to see him receive something. So give them each $25. There goes the $100. May he do that. There's no law which says that he must distribute the $100 on some kind of a ratio depending upon the number of hours that have been worked.
As if he wants to hire anybody next year or not.
Maybe a question of expediency.
It depends on other circumstances also.
Yeah, like suppose there are five more creditors who come in and say, don't pay any of those fellows $25. We want to be paid for the back bills on spray first, or for fertilizer first, and we'll take the money. Now may the owner of the vineyard say, well, I want to be gracious about this, and I'd like to give $25 to each of these four people. Suppose that the fourth person, the one who couldn't get out to the orchard because he got held up by his parole officer, says, you promised me $50 and I want $50. And I need it. Does he get $50 and the other guys take some lesser percentage? Suppose the one that worked all day said, you know, this really doesn't make any sense. There are four of us here. I worked 10 hours, he worked 5 hours, he worked 1 hour. That's 16 hours. We've got $100. Let's divide $100 by 16, comes out $6.25. I work 10 hours, I get $62.50. He worked 5 hours, he gets $31.25. He worked 1 hour, he gets $6.25. That's $100. The fellow didn't work at all, doesn't get paid anything. The fellow worked at all, said, look, you agreed to work for $50, now you want $62.50. That's not fair. Or is it?
Didn't the first two certainly had an agreement. There was an understanding between them for so much work for so much pay.
Yes.
It seems to me that's an agreement that would be enforced.
First one had an agreement for a fixed amount. The next one agreed to work for whatever was fair.
Yeah, the first, wouldn't that agreement be enforceable in court if necessary if it went that far?
For the full $50.
For the full $50, but not necessarily more. The second man that agreed to work for what's right, I think there is a minimum wage that applies. Maybe not to agricultural workers, but let's just assume that there is.
If not, Mr. Chavez, we'll get around to it.
Yeah.
Just going to say, that's why we get union contracts.
But my point is, those become enforceable even if we have to go into the guy's savings account, regardless of $100 he got for the peaches he delivered that day.
Yeah. Suppose he's wiped out by the Mediterranean fly. I mean, he's really bust now. No more assets. The Bankruptcy Act. Yeah. The Bankruptcy Act will tell us how to dispose of his assets. And if he says, but may I not be gracious? May I not do what I want with my own money? The answer to that is a thundering no. You may not. Well, fortunately, if he comes to a lawyer, the lawyer will get paid first.
Yes.
No. Not like that. Take it all back. First goes your tax.
Yeah.
And then goes some other expenses of handling the matter. Up here on the board, I have written, and you probably can't see, I'd like to read it to you, the form of a covenant. First is a preamble. Second is a historical prologue. The third is a stipulation or condition. The fourth is public access to the covenant and the reading of it, the announcement of it. Fifth is witnesses. And the last is blessings or curses. I, John Doe, being the owner of a piece of real property, the preamble, and having learned to know Mary Rowe and appreciating what she has done, wish to establish a trust of my land for her benefits. And therefore, that's the historical prologue, I hereby create a trust by giving the value, by selling the land and giving the value or conveying the land to a trustee, and instructing the trustee to give the value of this land to Mary Rowe in equal payments over the next 5 years on the condition that she lives that long and that she does not refuse to accept the money. Stipulations or conditions. This document is written and signed by me, and I direct that a copy of it be placed in the hands of the trustee and the hands of Mary Rowe so that she and they and anybody else who wishes will know what it says. And this document is witnessed by the persons who have signed beneath, and it is my hope that Mary will enjoy the proceeds from this property for the 5 years, and I know she will make great and valuable use of it. And if I do not do this, or if the trustee does not do this, the trustee and I will be liable, and we may be held for damages, and if it's necessary to bring an action against us, we will pay the cost of that action, including the attorney's fees of the party who enforces it, the blessings and curses. Now, this has been going on in that form since before Moses took the children of Israel out of Egypt. In the societies that predated Israel, when those people were not yet a people, they were just wandering donkey drivers, Eberu. The Hittites had precisely the same forms: preamble, historical prologue, stipulations and conditions, public access and the reading, witnesses and the blessings and curses. And last Monday, for those of you who were here, we thought a little bit about poor old Herod and John the Baptist, because Herod was responding to a covenant that he made under oath.
and said that I hate to cut off John's head, but I don't have any choice since I took an oath. And we thought a little bit about the Professional Air Traffic Controllers Association, who took an oath that they would never strike against the United States, but they found it necessary to do so because they're not being paid enough, and they feel that they're not bound by their oath. And we asked the question as to whether or not either one of those cases came out right. Should Herod have violated his oath? And I got help from some of you by saying he never should have made it in the first place. That's wonderful, except that he did. I got real help from Erling, who said he ought not to have felt obligated because he was drunk when he made his promise. That's very helpful. Maybe he should have said, look, you knew I was drunk. Maybe there were no expectations on Herodias's, the femme fatale in the plot, that ought to have been honored. Or maybe we all just ought to say it's wrong, therefore it ought not be done. Just wrong, that's all. I know it's wrong because when I think of it, my stomach goes irk. And therefore, Herod shouldn't have done it. Now, that's a little bit subjective. And yet, Mary, I believe, from the balcony said that it's the sign of a Christian to know when God's will demands that we do something. I'm misstating it, Mary, but at least there is an obligation on the part of Christians to know when God's will is in opposition to man's will, and therefore Herod shouldn't have done it. It was wrong. Some of the people who are professional air traffic controllers have elected to go to work even though they'd rather not, saying that they took an oath and they could face neither themselves nor God nor their family nor their children if they violated that oath. The question that I had about that was it wrong for the government to have asked those people to have taken an oath in the first place? Since when is God a law enforcement agency? And I'm deeply indebted to the panel last night that said that they don't like the notion of anybody saying, if we can't enforce this promise, this contract, if we don't have enough law enforcement machinery to get you for what you're doing, when you die, God will get you. And that makes God law enforcement super cop. I'll really knock you down. Is it impossible to relate the law and the gospel to each other? Don't they work in some sort of a constructive, effective tension? Should not Don, as a lawyer, or Les, or Dave?
Mark.
My professional colleagues, there may be more of you here, are those of us who practice law and therefore think about law enforcement, are we beyond the pale? The kingdom of God is like a man who said, am I not free to do what I like with my own and bless people by paying them more than the contract rate? But that avoids the tough question. What happens when the Mediterranean fruit fly hits and you don't have the assets? Then must you do it on some predetermined base that's, quote, fair rather than gracious? God made a covenant with Noah. God made a covenant with Abraham. And it had all of these things. I am the Lord. I am God. I am the one who brought you out of the water. I am the one who has called you from the other side of the flood. And if you will accept my blessing and not murmur against me and not reject my grace, the conditions, if you'll open your mouth so I can get to your teeth, I will bless you. And in order that everybody will know this, I make it public. A rainbow is a fairly public event. So is circumcision, Abraham. And everybody has access to this information.
And it's witnessed not only by people, but Larry would like this, but by the very stones and the trees and the water and the fish. And if man doesn't testify to God's greatness, the stones will. And if you live in this covenant with me, I will bless you. And if you do not, you'll have a toothache for the rest of your life. And God made a covenant with David. And we struggled with that last hour. And the same things happened. All of the pieces are there. And God made a covenant with Moses. I am the Lord thy God, the preamble. I am the one who brought you out of Egypt and out of slavery. I am the one who brought you across the Red Sea. I am the one who gave you manna in the wilderness. That's the historical prologue. No, that's who I am. And if you will receive my blessings, if you will not steal, if you will not commit adultery, if you will remember me before all other gods, if you will not engage in this self-destruction of covetousness, if you will not lie, I will bless you with the kind of unity as a body, a community, that'll be almost as good as Holden. Yeah. And everyone can know what the proper behavior is, proper now in the sense of how to open your mouth so that I can fix your teeth, because I've written it down. Moses has the copy, it's right there. And Moses, do keep them public. Put them in an ark. Have them carried with the people all the time. You people, write them. Put them before your eyes. Bind them on your wrists. Know what the circumstances are, the conditions. Oh, I'm not doing this because you don't lie. I'm doing this asking you not to lie so that you can trust each other. It's a condition. It's not part of the price. Moses didn't buy God's grace by saying, look, God, I've got a real hot organization going down here. You ought to see the team we're putting together. Man, we came through the Red Sea like a hot knife through butter. We knocked the Egyptians off without any trouble. And we've been going through the wilderness like a blizzard. You want to play? You sign up with me, God. You bless us and we'll front for you. It wasn't any such deal. It's striking, you know, that nowhere in Scripture does the word contract appear. We get covenants. We get agreements, we get conditions, but we don't buy anything, because grace means free. But you got to open your mouth before your teeth can get fixed. Well, write them on the tablets. Put the tablets in the ark. Read them to the people. They are witnessed by the very mountain. And if you do this, you will be blessed as no people has ever been blessed. And if you don't open your mouth and receive my loving care, you'll have a toothache for the rest of your life. That's what God did with Noah and with Abraham and with David, and with Moses. God promised to be graceful, and he did it in a form that they would understand.
that is the style, was one which they understood. And that style was not one of, if you will put a roof on my house, I will pay you $300. It was a style of, if you will open your mouth, I will fix your teeth free, because I know you can't pay, and because I want to help you out of your misery, and I will do this for you. Then came Joshua. Joshua, a woman named Miriam, later in the New Testament called Mary, used to step outside her front porch and yell for her son called Joshua, in Latin known as Jesus. Jesus, the person who crossed the river at the same place that Joshua crossed it years before. And Joshua, a great military general, said to 12 tribes, much like 12 disciples, there's going to be a new order around here. We've had kind of a loose federation wandering around in the wilderness. We've never really gotten organized. Now we're going to get organized. We're going to go across that river. We're going to take that land. We're going to make it ours. And we're going to cream the population over there. And if you fellas will provide the right number of troops, and if you will fight in the right way, and if we help each other, and if you do what you're supposed to do, if you support me, I'll support you, and we'll win, and we'll be a great nation. And if you don't, we're going to go back in this stinking desert and wander around for another 40 years. I am Joshua. I am the man that's been put here by Moses. I am the one that's been conducting the armies. I am the general. You promise me that you will fight, and your reward will be territory. So much for this tribe and so much for that. You fight, we pay. We're going to have a government. We're going to get organized. We're going to have a federation. And it's going to have laws. And not just my laws. There's Deuteronomy. It's God's laws. You do it the way that God says, we win. You don't do it the way God says, you get creamed. And if I don't get you, God will. Then there was Josiah. Just before the kingdom fell apart and they got captured by Babylon, who discovered the old book untouched for years, buried down in the rubble, he brought it out. It was the book of Deuteronomy. And he called all the people together and says, I know why things haven't been working around here. We've forgotten the law. Now we found it. Now we're going to get organized. I am the king. Preamble. I am the one who has been elected, selected, brought here, chosen to bring this nation safely away from the Babylonian threat. It's because the Babylonians are breathing on our doorsteps. We got to do something. You promise me that you will observe these laws. You do what you are obligated to do. What you are obligated to do is what Josiah said. You do what you are obligated to do. And if you will do that,
we, the government, will see to it that you are blessed and protected, and together in a social contract, we, the people, contracting together by our might, observing the law of God, will redeem our nation. And if we can't do that, well, we'll organize Congress or something and see to it that it gets done. If that doesn't work, well, we'll set up a Department of Agriculture. We'll get organized. And we'll write it out, and everybody can read it. Josiah said this book is going to be read in totality to all the people once every year so they'll know what their obligations are. And he did. He said, keep it, we get blessed, don't, you get cursed. There it is. It's a covenant form. And it didn't work. And they went into captivity. And then they came out of captivity. And then Ezra, trying to rebuild in the post-exilic period, used the same covenant form. And he did everything that Josiah had just done, only now he added something. And he said, some of you people just haven't been living up to what the law says. You know, you've been committing adultery. You've been covetous. You've been immoral. You've been violating God's instructions to you in the Ten Commandments. And so we're going to see to it you don't do that anymore. Now the law was to be enforced by the government. And it's no longer, if you will open your mouth, I will give you a working tooth. It's, brother, you're not working hard enough. You're not living up to your requirements as a citizen. And therefore, we're going to give you a little stimulation, one way or another. The Ten Commandments have become law in the sense of being requirements which you either keep or you get punished. When God gave them to Moses, the Ten Commandments were instructions about how to keep from becoming ill, how to open your mouth so that God could bless you. They were not requirements. They were only facts that had to occur. Open your mouth. They were conditions. Because I believe, using the word condition as I'm trying to define it now, that God's grace is always conditional. Marty, forgive me, wherever you are. I think last night Marty said God's love is never conditional. I assume, meaning that God never says, if you will do this for me, I will do that for you. It's never a bargain. It's never a contract. Ezra thought it was. Josiah thought it was. Joshua thought it was. They were perverters of God's grace. And so we come finally to the New Testament, in which Jesus says, I now give you a new covenant. And he goes back to the concept of God's grace, not forced, always on condition that the person will receive it, but never purchased, always free. God's unstinting grace, and he does it in a covenant form. I am your God. I am the one who's lived with you and has taught you. I am the one who a few hours from now will die. My blood is the seal. It's the sign. It's the rainbow. It's the circumcision. It's the public witness. It's the testimony. And if you are willing to receive my grace and be my witnesses, you will be blessed as no people has ever been blessed.
But if you reject this, then you must live outside of God's grace, not because God does not want you in His grace, but simply because God is gracious and will not compel you to accept His grace. Now have I completely divorced the gospel on the right, God's free gift of grace, from the kingdom on the left? You must pay an equal wage. You must do what you have promised in contract, because that's fair and it's just. And no, you may not do what you wish. But you must do what the law says. It's a requirement. And if you don't do it, in some way or other, we will compel you to do it or penalize you for not doing it. Last night, I heard someone say that the Constitution of the United States was rich. The Constitution of the United States is a beautiful document. It is God's poverty plan for people who cannot live in the fullness of God's grace. At least we can live at this minimal level of decency with each other. The best test that I know of for what is unconstitutional is when somebody does something that makes you want to throw up. That's unconstitutionality. It's the minimal level of decency that one person can have with respect to another person. It is not rich. It is not gracious. It simply says that you cannot take another man's life without first having due process to see whether or not it's fair.
You can't take his freedom, his liberty away from him without first having a trial to see whether it's fair. These are minimum protections to keep us from acting as less than powerful forces with respect to one another. Law is force. Holmes says law exists only in the end of a policeman's nightstick. If there's no remedy, there's no right. But remedy means compulsion. It means depriving you of your liberty. Joshua, Jesus, the Son of God, precisely gives us liberty. That's what it means to be called as God's redeemed, to have liberty, to be free, to act responsibly, but not being compelled. And how dare we, as a church, or as nominal Christians, say that God orders us to do as He commands, and if we do not, that He will punish us. Is that not a violation of the whole concept of covenant? Covenant in the sense of God with Noah and Abraham and David and Moses and with Christ. Isn't this a kind of perversion of the covenant that we see with Joshua and with Josiah and with Ezra? What was Constantine in the third century? Constantine said, I know what the church is good for, and this time you conquer. You put the cross before the army and we win. Put the cross away and we lose. Brief flicker, the concept of freedom, times the Reformation. The Lutheran Church existed for perhaps 20 years. And then we became a law enforcement agency again. Well, I must return. Then I'd like for you to talk. We ask for you, please. I'm a lawyer. I believe that it's better for people to spend their money trying things in a court and letting Don and I argue with each other, paid advocates, than it is for people to go out and fight it out. Trial by combat. Trial by combat is not very far back in our history, you know. Just a few hundred years ago, when two people were in disagreement, they were each given a short sword and they were bound to each other with a broad leather belt, and they went out and God brought the right person victorious out of that struggle. or they were thrown in a body of water with weight tied about them. And if they told the truth, the oath helper, they took an oath, they were telling the truth. If they told the truth, they floated despite the weight. They perjured themselves, they sunk because they took an oath. And God was the judge of that contest between human beings. Trial by combat, trial by ordeal. Put a hot iron in a person's hand to see whether or not he's lied. A lot of liars. Should God be the judge of a contest between two people who think that the roof on the house is not put on properly? Is my profession engaging in an ungodly exercise when you say that the vineyard employer may not do as he likes? Have we perverted Christianity by saying that God's love is never conditional? Conditional, now, read as a lawyer reads it. Yeah. You perverted the truth. Can law and gospel live together? Do you do God's will when by threat of punishment you say that women will no longer be discriminated in wages and that a person who employs a woman and a man must pay them the same job? What's that?
How do you improve upon the conscious
fact that God is not willing to go? Certainly it's much richer and better in life if we never get to the place where we cannot compromise our difficulties. God has given us a plan for successful living, to be one body, treating each other graciously. He has taught us to be servants of one another, to be loving and compassionate, and not self-seeking. Agree quickly with thine adversary while thou art yet in the way, lest you be taken to the judge, and the judge will throw you into prison. Verily I say unto you, you shall not come out from this until you have paid the last farthing. That's no longer true. We don't have that in prison. Quite that sense. My answer to you, Mark, is that God says if the way of life of grace is to be grateful. We are servants to each other. And if I am really moved by the compassionate life, the graceful life, the grace-filled life of Christ, and my brother thinks that I've done him a wrong, I'll go to my brother. And I will do what I can to see to it that my brother and I do not argue. And of course, not everyone is going to respond to that. There is the person who will beat me silly with a club, take my money away. And therefore, I must be practical, and I must carry a bigger club, and he raises one wide, slugging first. Because he is not in the household of God. And the passage that I wrote to you, read to you, says that the kingdom of heaven is life. Well, that's not the kingdom of heaven. That's more like Chicago Subway. And obviously, God's kingdom doesn't include Chicago Subway. Or does it? Or does it?
I just touched on something here. Whether the Subway contains the kingdom of God, I thought that God's kingdom and God's church was an instrument to serve the sinners. There are not saints to fill anybody's church. I think you need law, and maybe law be like thought, inspired by God, along with God's word, because of human nature itself. And then you go back and say, but God created man with his human nature.
Larry Rasmussen and very helpful at this point. I didn't even know there were two Hebrew words until Larry had his Bible study the other morning. One for man in his created state, one for man humanity in his lap. I like the statement that you don't fall. It isn't that you are higher, not that you are lower, hierarchical, but rather that you are you are trained. You're no longer within the bonds of God's love or the universe, because God makes us one body. When I go home at night, I really don't worry whether or not James is going to come up behind me and flood me with a baseball bat and take my money and run. He loves me. We are one body. I feel that same way when I'm sitting in the pew at Faith Vision Church. We are a body. We are a community. God has brought us together in His covenant. He has established us. But I honestly don't feel that way in Chicago Subway. And I'm a lawyer, you know? I'm a lawyer. And if somebody slugs somebody else with a baseball bat, and if I happen to be the prosecuting attorney, I'll go get him. At least I try.
John, I've had two times in my ministry when I have spent a lot of time with Lutheran audiences, mostly where there was great resistance to grace coming into contact or coming into the kingdom of government or what have you.
On the left.
First one.
So when God's grace doesn't work, what's left is left.
That's left. Okay. First one was as a director of the Social Service Agency, when I would talk to the congregations that supported our work in one way or another, they almost always asked me to assure them that all of the poor that we helped were deserving to assist. In some way, I have to say, you're not giving anything to someone who's not deserving. The second one was the National Ministry for Peace and Nonviolence, when there was great resistance to amnesty, and even had one person one time say, that was a legalized grace. That was a legal grace. But I think in a Lutheran tradition, we have encouraged the separation of the two kingdoms, meaning we do not expect grace to come in. We really want fairness or justice. Except maybe if we were the poor, or if it was maybe our son for whom the amnesty might be granted after Vietnam, but it might change it to kind of affect us.
Thank you, John. Yep.
I think sometimes it comes from the youth. I'm a lawyer, and one kid and I was over there clients like that, he's been poor for a long time, and I'm and we attempted to settle a matter, in fact, agreed to a settlement between lawyers. At a later point, the other lawyer called up and said, well, you know, it's time to tell you what my client agreed to, but he didn't want to pay after all. And that's been great. And I agreed to the other lawyer to have one of the clients do this. In any event, I sued him. He came into my office and is now ready to pay the original deal, and I have a little picture of him in the scripture. And he said, oh, Mr. Johnson, you're a Christian, can't you say, forget this whole thing. And it really was a difficult situation for me at that point. What is my responsibility, and what do I do then? And I try to say, look, I am a Christian, but you've been trying to amicably agree on this thing. I've got a responsibility to my client, and unfortunately, I can't just say, forget it, and go on your way. But that, to me, was something that brought home as vividly as anything, where we are in this whole thing. What is my responsibility? I think in my firm we now have a group of Christians who are going to carry out this discussion in terms of issues. And I think that maybe as far as we can go is our relationship with I represent the large corporations who have wanted to take a position with putting it legal. I think it just seems to me that we utilizing the process to make it difficult on somebody else because they weren't satisfied with how things have been going. And I think for those kinds of circumstances, being Christian is a fun word for me because I just thought I wouldn't do that. If they wanted to do that, they'd get another way. didn't quite make it back to that. Black and white, I don't make sense, but I mean, I didn't think that I could take black out from the people of course, but
it's still even in the to make a decision.
Yeah. But it's difficult in that one instance where it came to an officer. I had to really sit down and think, you know, what is my responsibility?
So Luther ran for the blood on this one. He said, in my own interest, never. In the interest of someone who's being abused, I'm strong and able to. Yeah, he's the one that called out the army. Yeah, he did. That horrible thing to all. Things are getting out of hand. You know? I don't know how many of you are, some of you are old enough to have been in the Second World War. I don't know how you handled that. I don't like war stories. But to make the point, before I was a man, I was an officer in the general. For those of you who are old enough, I was a flying pilot. I'm happy to announce that I haven't killed anybody in over 35 years. That's a terrible time like that. Now, Luther, the night before Pearl Harbor, that is non-violent. A week later, voluntarily in uniform. And I was too short. Because it seems to me that God sometimes says to us, you've got to make the unpleasant choice. You've got to make the unpleasant choice. It's the tragic choice that you have to make. Because if two persons are lost in conflict and will not be gracious, and the ultimate result will be violence, and perhaps one will even kill the other, which is not better, relatively, to have a system that makes it possible for them to have Johnson and Thorson fight it out. Johnson and Thorson, that sounds like that famous story about two Hittites. One in going, the other one. Now, isn't it better that they have a stylized battle before a judge, and then the judge does what seems to be fair, or not that he can make all the hurt and the harm and the pain go away, but at least he can prevent murder, violence? Isn't that better? Is that what God's kingdom on the left is about? And therefore, we legitimize Johnson and Thorson and Waltz and maybe even Regis in the activity of departing from grace and going to law, but at the same time always insisting as clearly as we can that God's relationship to me is never, never, never one of law. That the Ten Commandments are never, never, never law. It is not. It is God's position. For the receipt of his grace, I buy nothing. I have nothing to sell. God comes freely. And this young ruler has kept those commandments since his birth. Apparently, at least as the account is given, and he turns away sorrowing from God's kingdom. The malefactor on the cross, who was not up there for seeing Perina out of faith for him. That man was a violator of the law in serious enough terms that he was being crucified. Joined God in paradise that day. That's great. So this young ruler couldn't get his mouth open. That's the condition. Neither one is law. When God redeems me and brings me back into his community, he does it with joy. When I realize that it's not what I have done, it isn't that I did such a good job of roofing the house, or that I opened my mouth so wide, that God is compelled to give me a reward, but rather that finally I have realized that it is God's purpose to bless me if I will only be blessed. Now, do that for yourself. And we got Chris. We got Chris and we will. I'll talk to you some more next time. For yourself, really, with the legal system. Can you put any of grace in law, or is that destructive of law? The last part of the title for this morning, actually, take up the call. Can government ever be gracious? Or must it of necessity be fair? A power to come. Rather than God's wisdom.